From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Mandela Effect. I've been wanting to talk about that for a long time. Here's what's happening. For most people, gaming is an enjoyable hobby and a way to spend time with friends, but for some, it can become more than that. Gaming addiction, they say, has now been listed as a mental health condition for the very first time by the World Health Organization. And a lot of this, kids. Actress Heather Locklear taken to a hospital for a psych evaluation after a family member claimed the actress was threatening to kill herself. Law enforcement sources tell us a family member called 911 Sunday afternoon to report they were concerned for Heather, so they took her to the hospital for observations. Secret, Veterans Administration nursing home ratings hide poor quality of care from the public, from you. The worst performing VA nursing homes were scattered across 32 states, including Pennsylvania, which had 5 one-star facilities, as well as Texas and California, which each had 4. The VA facility in Bedford and Brockton, Massachusetts, were the only one-star nursing homes in New England there. Daniel Brinkley, who heads up the Twilight Brigade, which helps and assists our vets. What an appalling story, Daniel.
I agree with you, George. It's more than appalling, but what has to be really looked at is these ratings started in 2008. And then in 2009, when the Obama administration inherited them, they hid them. And what? You're talking 50,000 guys going through this. And, George, as people read and look at this, the cases of appendage amputees based on catheters and then, I hate to say, maggots in nasal passages.
Oh, gosh.
All this stuff has been hidden. And thank to President Trump, Obama hid it, the whole administration. And where we are today, George, this is what's so scary. We've been through 3 administrators. Okay, we have a temporary administrator. All the rules of what's come out with the Veterans Choice Program means they can go to nursing homes of their choice as opposed to be putting in this system. And I'm now watching the VA close out volunteers to come into the nursing homes because of the kind of psychotropic drugs that they're watching these veterans being given to manage and handle them, and they're trying to block volunteers from coming to see them. So I'm really glad. It's horrible, but I've been there 21 years, 33 years at the VA, and it's horrible and getting worse, but thanks to this, people are being able to see and make the right choices. So everybody owes President Trump a vote of gratitude, especially all veterans.
Well, he said he was going to start to fix the VA, so maybe that's happening, Daniel. Thank you. There is a very serious lack of trust in social media such as Facebook and Twitter, and consumers expect brands that advertise on such platforms to urgently find solutions. Privacy concerns and the circulation of fake news contributing to people's distrust of content on social platforms, according to a study by a public relations firm, which says that 70% of the respondents expecting businesses and advertisers to put pressure on social media sites to address false information and remove offensive content. And people are starting to turn away from some of these social networks. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet, with us. How widespread is this, Lauren?
Well, it's pretty widespread, but it shouldn't be considered surprising, right?
Because, right.
I mean, we can just look at all the bad press that Facebook got. And the concerns about that have been spilling out to the other services, sometimes rightly and sometimes not. Now, I've been clear. I don't trust Facebook. I don't use them. I've been happy over on Google Plus for many years. But regardless of the specific social media platform we're talking about, the individual has to decide how they're going to use it. I've always been concerned to see parents publicly posting photos of their children, including very young children, on these systems. Because, you know, those photos, if they're public, they can be abused by other persons. They could come back to haunt those kids much, much later.
Sure.
Hopefully, we can all still agree that protecting children in social media and other ways from abuse and making sure their parents have what's needed to protect them on these systems in other ways, you know, is still important. Admittedly, looking at the news right now, maybe caring about children and their parents isn't considered the American way anymore. I don't know. But in the final analysis, It's individual social media users that have to take the responsibility for themselves and for their children. If you depend on the platforms for airtight privacy, if you expect them to protect you, then you're in for real trouble, because you have to decide for yourself what you're willing to post and whether or not, thinking for the future, thinking about tomorrow, whether or not you're going to be comfortable with the prospect of those posts possibly being out there in one form or another for many years yet to come, even if there's privacy problems. So, you know, it's really a think before you post, think before you let your children post.
Good advice, Lauren. Always good advice from you. About a month ago, we had a picture posted on coasttocoastam.com of some wolf-like looking creature that was killed in Montana. It was really strange. Well, now the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department revealed the identity of the mysterious wolf-like creature that was shot in the head last month. The officials say that it was a gray wolf, even though it really doesn't look like a wolf. Montana officials say they were not certain what the creature was when a rancher fatally shot it on his property. Scared the living daylights out of him. President Donald Trump has vowed to make space great again. Speaking at a meeting of the National Space Council, Mr. Trump ordered the Pentagon to immediately establish a national space force that would become the sixth branch of the armed forces. That's pretty interesting there. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, George. Hey, after the show, I think I'm going to sign up for the Space Force. You want to join me?
I will.
That'll be fun.
As long as I can take my Navy rank with me, I'll be happy.
Absolutely. I'm going to make that happen if I can. But, George, things are happening again. Let's go back to the planet Mars, because last week, a lot of excitement, a lot of emails, and a lot of people want to know. More on Mars, folks. The incredible dust storm that started back on the 30th of May in a region of Mars, which we call Mare Acidalium, simply known as the Sea of Venus, go figure, on the surface of Mars. This dust storm has gotten so large that if you look in the telescope right now, and this is where the encouragement comes, if the listeners out there have a moderate-sized telescope, you may want to start watching Mars if you haven't already, because this storm, George, is now well over 7 million square miles, larger than the entire area of North America.
Gosh.
And something that people should know, when Mars comes toward its perihelion, or closest to the sun, we know that Mars will be closest to the Earth coming up in late July. But somehow, Mars does this, and it's kind of sad. It's sometimes when it gets close to the sun and close to us, it kind of covers itself in dust. So now might be an opportunity. Mars is only some 46 million miles away. It gets closest to us, as I mentioned before, in late July by about 35 million miles. But in the live sky, here's something that I'm sure everybody will enjoy out there. If you begin, George, looking into the sky as the sun sets, as we move toward the solstice in a few days, the planet Venus is that beautiful bright beacon in the sky. Just follow it to the left. Unmistakably, you'll see the first quarter moon as we move toward the 20th. Continue that arc in the sky, because here's the rest of the show. You'll see the amazing planet Jupiter, easy to see with the naked eye, a host of satellites and binoculars and telescopes. Follow the arc again across the sky, known as the ecliptic path, the path of the sun, moon, and the planets. You'll come upon Saturn, a great planet. And then right now, as many observers are probably looking in the sky, the planet Mars rises. It's absolutely spectacular. Go look at it in the telescope now. The southern polar cap is easy to see in a moderate-sized telescope. Dr. Sky reminds you always to keep your eyes to the skies. Email me, I love it, at Dr. Sky, that's DRSKY, at Cox.net.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. Devastating floods ravaged Michigan's Upper Peninsula this weekend, leading the state's governor to declare a state of disaster in two counties. Some areas were hit with up to 8 inches of rain. That's a lot of rain. That's 80 inches of snow, by the way, if it were cold. Up next, Dr. Tim Ball joins us for a couple hours. His latest work is called Human-Caused Global Warming, but the subtitle, The Biggest Deception in History. Tim is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Tim Ball calls it the largest and oldest fake news story created and perpetrated through the deep state of the bureaucracy. Mary McCarthy, of course, has described this as follows. Bureaucracy, the rule of no one, has become the modern form of despotism. And, of course, Dr. Tim Ball with us with his latest work, Human-Caused Global Warming, with the subtitle, which is very important, The Biggest Deception in History. Tim, welcome back, Doc.
Well, thank you, George, and thanks for the opportunity to talk to the public again and provide them with the other side of the story. That's always the important issue.
Every time you're on, somebody calls and says, what are your credentials, Mr. Ball? So let's get them on the table right now, Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the credentials come actually before I went back to university. I was in the Canadian Air Force. And by the way, the Canadian military and their veterans are treated far worse than in the U.S. We're almost non-existent. But anyway, I did 4 years of anti-submarine over the North Atlantic during the Cuban crisis. And then I did 5 years of search and rescue in the Arctic, northern and Arctic Canada. And of course, I had to learn about weather and weather forecasting. And one of the things that I learned from that experience was the forecasts were terrible. In fact, to give you an idea of how little we know about the world, when I first started flying in the Arctic, the maps we had for quite large areas of Canada were marked terra incognita, in other words, unknown land, and of course, the lack of weather stations. So when I lost my flying category and I chose to get out of the military because, I didn't want to fly a desk, I decided to go back to university and find out why the weather forecasts were so bad. And at that time, the whole new idea of environmentalism was coming in. For example, a very important book called Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth came out in about 1968. And so those things combined in me to look at both environment, but also what was wrong with weather and climate forecasting. And so I went, I did an honors degree where I looked at the philosophical side of it. Why were humans not considered as an agent of change in nature? And then the master's thesis was a very specific science MA, looking at energy and energy inputs. And of course, as we know in today's world, energy is absolutely essential to everything. And energy in nature helps you understand what moves the weather, what creates the weather, and so on. And then my doctoral thesis, teamed up with, and I was lucky to be able to go to the climatic research unit in East Anglia. And the head of that was Hubert Lamb. And Lamb, during the war, had the same problem that came across the same problem I had. That is that he was making forecasts for bombers over Germany, and they were coming back and saying, you know, you almost killed us. You told us it'd be clear sky, and we had freezing rain, and so on. So after the war, he decided to set up the Climate Research Unit, which, of course, later became perverted for the biggest deception. But anyway, Lamb said, look, until we can figure out how much the climate has changed in the past, we haven't got a hope of figuring out and understanding the mechanisms and forecasting for the future. So that's where it really all began. And so I ended up reconstructing a 300-year weather record for Central Canada from both the daily journals and meteorological records of the Hudson Bay Company, because there was a company whose whole existence depended on the weather and so on, and fur trapping, and then also living off the land. And to give you an idea of how progressive they were, they brought thermometers and barometers to Churchill on Hudson Bay as early as 1768. So that's my background and why I got into this whole idea of what's wrong with weather forecasting and climate forecasting. But of course, when I started out, global cooling was the consensus. And then I watched the whole area, my discipline of climate hijacked for the political agenda of global warming, which of course has led to the book that I wrote.
And Tim, let me ask you this, regardless of the cause, and we'll get into it in a big way tonight, but regardless of the cause, is there global warming? Is the planet heating up?
The planet, no, not right now. It's actually since 1998, the planet has cooled down slightly. And
we had the hottest May in 100 years, they said.
Yeah, but you really have to look at that and look at the record and how they come up with those numbers. This is part of the deception. When I tell you that, for every weather record around the world, every station, they've lowered the historic record. So the temperature record for the late 1900s and early 20th century, they lowered those temperature records, which of course then made it look like the warming was greater than it actually was. We took the New Zealand government to court for doing exactly that. And I was also part of a group that confronted the Australian government for the adjustments they were making to their record. And to give you an idea of how deceptive this is, they tell you, oh, the 1990s outdoors out there, 1990s the warmest on record. In fact, particularly in America, the 1930s was much warmer than the 1990s. So the record, as they're presenting to you, has been so distorted. That's part of the deception. They've had to, in order to maintain their claims, and when the evidence comes up to show they're wrong, they have to distort the record and try and contradict it, and that's what's going on there. But just to finish my comment, if we start, say, in 1860, the world warmed up to about 1900, or sorry, it cooled down to 1900, and then from 1900 to 1940, it warmed up, and by the way, in that 40 years, it warmed up more than it did from 1980 through to 2000. And then from 1940 to 1980, the world cooled down, which is, of course, when I started, and the CIA were writing reports on how the cooling was going to cause social chaos all over the world. And then from 1980 to 1998, the world warmed up, and then since 1998, the world has been cooling down slightly and will continue to cool. So you don't have to look at much of the record to see that the climate varies all the time. And to put the current warming in perspective, if you look at the last 12,000 years, a period called the climatic optimum or the Holocene optimum, the last 12,000 years, about 96% of it, 95-96% of it, was warmer than it is today. And so you see how they've distorted the record, and the minute you start putting it into context, which is why I went to do my PhD, you start to realize that what's going on today is perfectly normal, perfectly well within all natural variability.
And Tim, how many people have confused pollution for global warming?
Well, that's a very good question. And of course, the fact that Obama was running around saying carbon pollution. I mean, first of all, he's not talking about carbon. Carbon's a solid. He's talking about CO2.
Right.
CO2 is not a pollutant. It's an absolutely essential gas in the atmosphere. But the idea of carbon, of course, it brings across the idea of soot. And, of course, those people attacking the coal industry and saying, oh, coal's causing the problem. And you saw how Obama said that you could do coal, but I'll tax you out of business. So the idea that CO2 is a pollutant is part of the deception. Now, the difficulty with that, of course, is that there are pollutants. There are things that
and we do want a clean environment.
Exactly.
No question.
Yeah, well, exactly, and that's the whole point, George. Is that these people, and I say these people, the environmentalists, go around saying, we're the only ones that care about the environment. Well, how dare you? How arrogant. It was like when I appeared before a Canadian parliamentary committee on the ozone issue. There were seven people there representing a group called Friends of Earth. And I said, well, what does that mean? If you're not in our group, you're not a friend of the Earth? How dare you? But this is the high ground moralizing that has been going on. And, everybody's for a clean environment. It certainly makes no sense to pollute your own nest. And, of course, that's why I mentioned in my earlier comments about starting in the 60s when the whole new paradigm of environmentalism came in. It was a necessary one.
Indeed it was. Tim, give us your website. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and find out who started all of this hoorah about global warming. Your website is drtimball.com, drtimball.com, DR. That's simple as that. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And where do people get the book, Human Caused Global Warming?
The book is available. I've got it on the front page of my website, but Amazon is as good as anyone.
Okay, it's a good read. It's got a lot of great information for people who are into weather, too. You could tell that you've done some homework here. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Tim Ball. We will take calls with Dr. Ball next hour here on Coast to Coast AM, so get ready to make those calls in about 30 minutes. We'll be back. All right, lots going on. Just check my calendar of events at coasttocoastam.com. June 30th, I'll be in Vancouver, British Columbia at the Architects of the New Paradigm Conference. Really looking forward to that. Some real special guests are coming. So if you have a passport, come on up to Canada. And if you're Canadian, come on over to Vancouver, British Columbia. Again, full info at our events at coasttocoastam.com. And then, of course, August 25th, we're going back to Asheville, North Carolina. I love that town. We're going to have a special live event at the Diana Wortham Theater. That website is dwtheatre, theatre.com. You can pick out your own seats that way. Just type my name in the events and then start clicking away. Special guests, of course, including paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren, spiritual teacher and psychic medium Vincent Jenna will be there. We'll have a live band and all kinds of things with a great meet and greet afterwards. Always a meet and greet, and we do not leave until the last person has had that chance to meet us. So go to the events at coasttocoastam.com and click the icon for Asheville. We are back with Dr. Tim Ball. His latest book is called Human Caused Global Warming, The Biggest Deception in History. Tim, when did this officially start in terms of when it was getting its most widespread publicity that it was man-made global warming?
Well, it actually went public in 1988, but it had already started prior to that. And the reason I'm saying 1988 is because that is when Senator Timothy Wirth, in conjunction with Al Gore, brought a guy by the name of James Hansen, who was a low scientist at NASA GIS, the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, a sub-branch of NASA, and they brought him before the Senate committee because he was willing to say that he was 99% certain that humans were causing global warming. I mean, there's no evidence to support that at all, but he was willing to say it. Hansen, of course, later went on to have an incredible career as a bureaucrat because he was arrested three times outside the White House protesting, and yet he was a senior bureaucrat in government, yet never got charged under the Hatch Act. So that's the time it went public. But the whole concept had actually started in the 1960s with the Club of Rome. That's where the whole thing began. And by the time it got to 1988, the whole structure was in place. And by the way, just to give you an idea, when I talk about the biggest deception, and you can read about what Wirth did, Timothy Wirth did, and his interview was on PBS Frontline. So you just type in PBS Frontline Timothy Wirth interview, and it'll pop up. And what they did was they got Hansen, and they said, okay, let's make this really effective. Let's find out what's the hottest day of the year in Washington, and that's the day they planned the meeting or the hearing for. And then they went in the night before and opened up all the windows and shut off all the air conditioning. So everybody was
sweltering.
Was stage managed. Yeah, it was beautiful. But that sort of thing, by the way, is not unusual in this whole deception. But it just illustrates what goes on. But the whole thing began, George, because of and I was interested to hear you going to this paradigm conference in Vancouver. Paradigm shifts are very the way that society changes, and the new paradigm is brought in, and everybody looks at it and say, well, yeah, there's some good ideas there, but a few people, a small group, see the potential for both financial and power politics in it and grab it right away. The majority are sitting there saying, well, yeah, there's some good ideas, but the public are leery of change. And the reason they're leery of change is because they've learned from history that when change occurs, somebody gets hurt, and it just might be them. And so they tend to be small-c conservative with regard to change. And so what happened was the environmental movement came in as a paradigm shift. And the small group of people that grabbed it were based with the Club of Rome, which was established in Rome by David Rockefeller in 1968, and they saw this as a potential for getting basically political control, and this is one way, by the way, that where I, well, not one of the things, but I mean
one of many.
Well, yeah, but it was like Limbaugh was to follow the money. Yeah, follow the money.
Well, I was just going to bring that up to you, too. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the money is only important for smaller people like you and I. When you start to get up to the George Soros and the Maurice Strongs and Rockefellers, it's all about power. They know that the money will come with the power, but that's not their prime objective. So you have to sort out. And of course, when it comes to power, it narrows down to a very small group of people. And of course, as Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, said, everything's always done and started by a small group of people. And so these extreme environmentalists at the Club of Rome saw the opportunity for this to impose a whole new political system upon the world. And it's interesting because we're into the 50th anniversary of Paul Ehrlich's book, the Population Bomb. And that was really what they were concerned about. They were concerned that the world was overpopulated and that with development, these people were increasing in number every year and they were using more and more resources every year, and therefore the world was going to run out of resources. And this is based on the Malthusian idea, by the way, where Malthus said that the world population would outgrow the food supply. Well, Malthus was wrong, and Paul Ehrlich was absolutely wrong. In fact, if you look at Ehrlich's predictions, it's a wonder he's even got any credibility left at all, yet somehow he does. And he, by the way, worked with John Holdren. They published a book together called Eco-Science, Population, Resources, and Environment, in which they were saying that compulsory abortion would become necessary in order to reduce the population. I mean, really frightening stuff. And so. The whole theme of this then was the world's overpopulated. It's got to be reduced because we're running out of resources.
Mm-hmm.
So they did very simple experiments and they produced a book called Limits to Growth, in which they said, okay, here's the resource we've got now. Here's the rate at which we're using it. Here's the rate at which that's going to increase, and here's the year by which we'll run out of that resource.
What is their agenda, Tim? What are they trying to get out of this?
Well, that's exactly the point, and that's why I've written this book, because once you start to realize that they've corrupted and misused and abused, what's the motive? And the motive is, of course, given by and Maurice Strong is the person, and he just died in China a couple of years ago. I'm sad to tell you he's a Canadian. But he was a member of the Club of Rome, and in a book called Cloak of Green, an investigative journalist back in the days when we had them still around, a woman by the name of Elaine Dewar, she said, well, what's the problem for the planet? And he said, the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them?
Would you explain, too, though, the Club of Rome to people who don't know what that is?
Yeah, well, the Club of Rome, as I said, was a group of people that started meeting and met in, the first meeting was in Rome, organized by David Rockefeller.
1968.
And their focus became the environment and the overuse of resources. And basically, it was about how we've got to control people. We've got to control the numbers of people, and we've got to control how they behave. And they brought out a book called the First Global Revolution, but Maurice Strong was a member of that, and as I said, he was interviewed and said that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? Dewar said, well, how do you go about doing that? If you want to do that, why don't you run for politics? And he said, you can't do anything as a politician. Well, of course, that's what everybody's finding out now. Even Trump is finding out the swamp is really unmovable. But anyway, he said, well, I'm not going to run for politics. I'm going to go to the United Nations and do what I there.
Control that way.
Yeah, well, he said, I can raise all the money I want from whomever I want and appoint anyone I want and control the agenda. And that's precisely what he did. So he went there and set up the United Nations Environment Program, and the Rio Conference in 1992 was his orchestration, and he chaired that. And this is where Agenda 21, this strategy for the globe for the 21st century, was introduced. George Herbert Walker Bush refused to go to it. He said it's a socialist agenda, and I'm not going to have anything to do with it. And he refused to go. So the Rio conference was really the turning point. But anyway, after spending 5 days with Strong at the United Nations, Elaine Dewar summarized her 5 days with him. She said, Strong was using the United Nations as a platform to sell a global environment crisis and the global governance agenda. So, of course, this is why they needed the global warming issue. First of all, you could show that the industries were, their byproduct of industry was CO2, and it was caused, as it increased in the atmosphere, the temperature would go up and it would cause runaway global warming. They needed something that threatened the globe. It had to have a global impact because they needed to overcome nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to be able to say no one nation can cope with this.
It's a globalist agenda?
Yeah. And so that's why global warming was chosen. And I mean, Wirth made the comment, he said, it isn't about global warming at all. He said, this is all about establishing equality and fairness in the world. Wirth actually said that. And of course, Wirth ended up, he quit the Senate and was hired by Ted Turner. And part of the $1 billion that Turner gave to the United Nations went to fund a climate foundation, which Wirth then ran and promoted this whole thing. So it was all orchestrated through the Club of Rome and the members of it. Other members of it, I mentioned Ted Turner, Mikhail Gorbachev, and people like this were all members of the Club of Rome. But the person that was most instrumental in putting this plan into action was Maurice Strong. As I said, he went to the UN and he set it up through the United Nations Environment Program, and that was where they created the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Who pulled off the Paris Climate Accord? How did that get done? And you had 178 signatories there in terms
of
countries.
What happened was that the original plan to control the industrialized nations was to make them pay for their sins of getting wealthy using burning fossil fuels. So they identified 23 of them through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They became what was called Annex A, the 23 developed nations, industrialized nations. They had to pay money into a pot, which was then going to be given to the other nations that had suffered because these people had got wealthy using fossil fuels. And that was the whole basis of the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol was blown up in two ways. One is, because it was a treaty, and I'll get around to your Paris climate question, but because it was a treaty, the Kyoto had to be approved by the Senate. The U.S. Senate didn't want to vote on the Kyoto Protocol because they didn't want to be seen voting against something that was agreed. And so what they did was, this is a typical political maneuver, they set up the Byrd-Hagel resolution, which said, should we vote on Kyoto? Okay? And in that, and it's interesting to go and read the debate on that, the Byrd-Hagel resolution. During the debate on that, they said, no, the cost of reducing CO2 is going to completely cripple our economies, our industry, and it will kill off jobs everywhere. And so they voted 95 to nothing, with Al Gore in the Senate, by the way, 95 to nothing, not to vote on the Kyoto Protocol. That was the first thing that killed it. The second thing that killed the Kyoto Protocol was that it was due to be ratified at what are called the Conference of the Parties. These are political groups controlled by bureaucrats and politicians, which decide every year how much money is going to be spent on climate change and how much money to put to the research of it. They can only operate with the science that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change give them, Well, they were due to meet in Copenhagen in December of 2009. And then in November of 2009, somebody leaked these emails from the Climatic Research Unit at East Anglia.
Which were devastating, right?
Oh, yeah, it was devastating. And it showed just how corrupt the science was. I mean, that they were getting editors filed. In fact, I can read you a summation of a book that was done on the Climate Gate, as it became called. On the back of the book by the authors, they say, they actively worked to evade McIntyre's freedom of information requests, deleting emails, documents, and even climate data. They tried to corrupt the peer review principles that are the mainstay of modern science, reviewing each other's work, sabotaging efforts of opponents trying to publish their own work, and threatening editors of journals who didn't bow to their demands. They changed the shape of their own data in materials shown to politicians charged with changing the shape of our world, hiding the decline that showed their data could not be trusted. Well, that came out in November 2009. As you said, it was devastating. But so Copenhagen didn't approve the Kyoto Protocol. In fact, it got shot right out of the water. But the following year, because these people don't give up, I mean, this is what Trump is facing. They simply don't give up. So in Durban the following year, they had another of these Conference of the Party meetings at which they introduced something called the Green Climate Fund. And the Green Climate Fund was a simple replacement for the Kyoto Protocol. But the Green Climate Fund required that these 23 nations have to put in $100 billion every single year, and that money goes into a bank in South Korea and then is redistributed to these other countries. And by the way, to tell you why Trump quit the Paris Climate Agreement, part of the agreement is that America has to put in a very large chunk of money. China gets to draw $2 billion out of the fund because they're considered a developing nation.
Wow, we put it in, they take it out.
Exactly. I mean, that's why Trump got out of it. But anyway, the Paris Climate meeting was, to ratify the Green Climate Fund that had been approved in Durban in 2010. And of course, Obama knew he could never get it approved by the Senate, so he didn't call it a treaty. He called it an agreement. And the nations that, they could ratify it, so they all look green, but none of them have to implement it. It's not a binding agreement at all. It was just something that looked good for the world stage, for the whole continuation of the deception,
and it continues.
Oh, it continues, of course. Oh, yeah. I mean, but think about the trillions of dollars that have been spent on this. Think about the fact that when Maurice Strong set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he did it through the UN, he did it through the World Meteorological Organization, which is made up of every bureaucrat from every national weather office of every country in the world. So by doing it that way, he then controlled the bureaucrats that controlled all the weather and climate research in every country. They then, of course, can control the politicians. And that was done deliberately. So what you got, that's why I say it's a deep state and why the Mary McCarthy quote is so relevant to this whole thing. And when you look at the role of NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, their role in this, the United Kingdom Met Office, Environment Canada. In fact, the first meeting of the IPCC to get organized in 1985 was chaired by a guy by the name of Gordon McBean, who later became an assistant deputy minister at Environment Canada.
All right, Tim, hold on. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, Human-Caused Global Warming, the Biggest Deception in History, and an hour of phone calls next with Dr. Tim Ball on Coast to Coast AM.